Well, welcome to this session here. I'm Brian Moore. I'm going to be doing a session on the Isle of Iona, a community in Scotland that I worked at for 2 months. It was March of 86, I think it was. I lose track of the year sometimes, but it wasn't too long ago. What I want to do is give a brief outline about what the Iona community is. And I've got a map up here to give you an idea where it's located. And I'm also going to give you a bit of a history of the Isle of Iona, and I'm also going to let you listen to some music from Iona Abbey. We did a concert last Saturday night. If any of you were here for the concert, you heard some of the music that I picked up when I was in Scotland at the Abbey. So I'll let you listen to a bit of that also. And the music I had on here just as we were coming in, sitting down, was a friend of mine named Bill Rattray, who's a fellow who lives, he works at a boys' institution just outside of Glasgow, and he put a tape together for me of his music. He's a very fine Scottish guitarist and vocalist, and he sent me the tape over after I arrived back to America again. First of all, let me show you where Iona is. People ask and say, well, it's in Scotland, and it's off the west coast of Scotland. If you're familiar, well, I flew in to London. From London, I took a train up to Glasgow. They say Glasgow, they say. And from Glasgow, I took another train out to a little town called Oban. This is a port town. From Oban, I took a boat out to the Isle of Mull. It's about a 45-minute boat ride. And once I got to the Isle of Mull, I took a bus around the Isle, in and out of the mountain, the hills, actually. That was about 2 hours to the other side of the Isle of Mull. And once I reached the other side of the Isle of Mull, I took another boat over to the Isle of Iona. So you think Holden is isolated. Iona is just as isolated. And it's just about out here. It's not listed on this map. This is it's a small little island. They say a wee little island off the west coast of Scotland. So anyway, this is about where it's at. Takes a whole day to get there from Glasgow. Iona community is located there on the Isle of Iona. It's said by mystics to be the center of the spiritual universe or the center of the mystic universe. And after I had been there for a while, I began to understand what they meant by that. My first impressions were I sailed across from the Isle of Mull on a very windy, rainy day. I felt like I was in this little boat. It's a very small boat they take you across on. Not a rowboat, but a little bit smaller than the Lady of the Lake. It's maybe, if you've been up here in the wintertime, it's about the size of the boat that you take up here in the wintertime, about half the size of the Large Lady. And I didn't see any trees on the island at all. Oh man, what am I getting myself in for? I come from Oregon, and I love trees. I love mountains and all their, a lot of hills and high hills. But no trees, very rocky, a lot of heather, a lot of marsh area, and a lot of sheep everywhere. One thing I learned to do over there was to herd sheep. I found out you don't chase the sheep, you walk behind them. And I learned that sheep in Scotland don't say ba, but say ma. So something I learned when I was there. The island's very windy. Only on a few days that I was there, and I was there for about 2 months, the wind didn't blow, but most of the time the wind blew. I went out walking to the sea one day and my hat blew off and almost blew down into the water. It was so windy out. It reminded me a lot of the Oregon coast, if anyone's ever seen the Oregon coast. Well, there are always clouds there, which isn't true of the Oregon coast, but very rocky, rough sea. If any of you are familiar with Mendelssohn's Fingal's Cave is nearby the Isle of Iona as well. And they took tourist boats out there to Fingal's Cave. The abbey is not the only building on the island. The island is occupied by, I think, 60 to 75 other people that herd sheep. It's all sheep herders, and they call them abbeyites. Plus two stores and two youth hostels and the all-important pub. They gotta have their pubs. I got there and I said, they said to me, well, you're going to live in the cloisters. So I took my bags and moved into the cloisters, this place where the monks used to do all their praying and reading and studying. Very small little rooms. They make these rooms here at Holden seem very large in comparison. And it was pretty overwhelming for me to think that people had been there for centuries and centuries and centuries in the same room that I was sitting in right there. It was very cold. There was no central heating whatsoever. Everything was by coal. There was no heat in our room at all, so I slept in my sleep bag most of the time with a few wool blankets over top. I heard about Iona through a friend of mine who had worked at a place in England called Horthrop Hall, and he passed a list on to me of volunteer places all over the world. So about summer of 84, when I was working up here, I started writing out to various places all over the world thinking, well, maybe when I graduate from college, I'll go overseas and travel for a while. So I started to work on it, and things fell together. I received some information back from Iona and an application, filled the application out, and about 10 days before I was planning to leave, I hadn't heard from Iona yet. I had said that at the place I was working that I was going to be leaving the job, so I was taking a chance that Iona would work out for me. And about 10 days before my plane ticket, I was set to leave on the plane, I got a call from Scotland. My brother came running down the stairs and says, hey, Brian, there's a woman on the phone. She sounds like she's English or Scottish or Irish or something like that. And I was really excited. Oh, wow, this is great. So maybe I'm finally going to go. And so I got on the phone, and sure enough, they wanted me to go. And they actually paid my way to Iona from London and back again to London. Plus, they paid my boat fare out to the Isle of Iona. And they gave you about £12 a week, which is about $18 as a stipend. And a lot of people use it for the pub, you know. Me included, I use it there once in a while. Iona is a volunteer community. It's similar to here at Holden. It's run totally by volunteers. They have people who are there, they call them the bursars. They were there for anywhere from 3 to 5 years, and they run the program, similar to Elmer here. There are people who are there for usually 1 to 2 years, people who are the heads of various departments, maybe the cook, the head cook, will be there for 1 to 2 years as a volunteer. The person who's running the recreation or the person who's running the maintenance are there for the 1 to 2 years, as I said. And then there are folks who are there for 3 to 5 months, who are the other heads of the department, say the head of the coffee house, or the head of the laundry, or the head of this, or the head of that. Similar to here at Holden, we have people here for a long time, people here for kind of in between, and people here for 3 weeks. And then they had people who were there, say, from 3 to 5 weeks, and in my case, 2 months, considered more of the short-term staff. So I was there from about March, early March through early May at Iona. I worked in the coffee house, which is a building. I wish I had pictures. I don't. I didn't take slides over there. I have a lot of photographs, but I sent them down to Oregon. So if you're ever in Oregon, stop by and I'll show you pictures. You know. I got to find them. They're all buried in my father's house somewhere. But I worked in the coffee house, and the coffee house is located right nearby the Abbey. It's a place where the people who are staying there as guests go to get scones, or they call cookies, biscuits and tea and coffee and all sorts of things. I taught them how to make chocolate chip cookies. They never had them before until I went there. Maybe I shouldn't have done that, but they liked them. I even taught them how to make deep dish pizza. But mostly, I learned a lot about their kind of foods, and that was really important, more important to me than teaching them my sorts of foods. I learned how to eat all sorts of shortbreads and shortcakes, and learned to drink tea, which I never did much of before I was over there. I don't drink it much anymore, but when I was there, I learned to do it. When in Scotland, do as the Scots do, they say. So I did a lot of baking and did a lot of waiting on people. I had to learn to think in sterling instead of in dollars, and that took me some adjustment. But I got used to it. I was able just to think very clearly in sterling after a while. And that's what I did for 2 months. I was working in the coffee house. A lot of tourists come on the island as well. The island is very, very famous. A lot of history. I'm going to give you some history of the island after a while. There's a boat that sails from, I believe it starts from down on the port of London. It's Harwich. And it sails up in and out of the Western Hebrides, and it stops. So sometimes in the summertime, 200 to 300 people will get off the boat and converge upon the abbey. And all the sheep go running, you know. And the coffee house is busy. You have lions out the door. You know, I think the snack bar is busy here. Go check out the coffee house sometime at Iona. But they're all there to see the old abbey and to see what's going on the Isle of Iona these days. The old abbey is built in 563. It's this old, big old stone structure. It hasn't been standing since 563. It's been ransacked a few times by the Vikings. Various other Scandinavian people, you know, like a lot of us, you know. To sit in the abbey where, you know, monks and people have sat, and priests and all sorts of people all through history, been sitting there for centuries and centuries and centuries. It's really very fascinating. So I can imagine all the feet, people who have all walked, you know, on the floor of this old stone abbey, all the voices that have talked in there, and all the different ways of thinking. People can think different ways, and stained glass window, and all sorts of history. I wanted to go back and bring a brass quintet over there and play in the abbey. The acoustics are just wonderful. The sound just resonates. They don't need microphones there. This sound comes alive inside the abbey. The abbey itself, they do a lot of work on the social, they do a lot of social ministry. It's similar to Holden in a lot of ways. They talk about problems in Scotland. Scotland is very high, has very high unemployment. They talk about issues around greater United Kingdom. They talk about issues in the rest of the world. They talked a bit about the problem in Central America. They talked about the Soviets in Afghanistan. They talked about the problems in South Africa. In fact, they used the same music there, the South African freedom songs that Holden uses. I became familiar with those songs there before I came back here again. So they're very social-minded, and at the same time that they're outward, they're also very inward. A lot of times of silence and times for meditation and reflection. There isn't a lot of there's program going on, but I would say it's not quite as much as here at Holden. Time is a little bit slower. There's a lot of time for coffee breaks. And I'll give you an idea of the typical day. But I just want to emphasize that it is social-minded, and it's a social-mindedness that comes out of an inwardness. We worshiped twice a day. A typical day would start, I think, at 8 o'clock. There's only one setting of each meal. We had breakfast, and then we worked for maybe 2 hours, then we have the morning coffee break or tea break, and then we go to lunch a couple hours later, and then we have another tea break mid-afternoon, and then we go to what they call tea, which is actually dinner. That took me some getting used to. Someone said, "Hey, do you want to go to tea?" I thought, "Oh, well, I don't like tea very much." So I went, and I found out it was dinner, so I had to learn a whole new lingo. Sure, let's go to tea. Let's see, by tea time we'd have 1, 2, 3, 4 tea breaks. And then there would be, during the afternoon there would be sessions, maybe one or two sessions, or time for people to walk around the island. They had they called a pilgrimage around the island. You walk most of the way around the island, stopping at various points. It's like going on a walk, stopping at the points of the cross. we'd have a tea break in the evening also. So we had a lot of tea over there. That's why I got used to drinking. It's kind of a social thing. And we had worship after breakfast at about 9 o'clock in the Abbey, very brief, about 20-minute worship service. They stick very close to the liturgy. It's very similar to the Presbyterian Church. If any of you have been to the Presbyterian Church, it's very similar. A lot of the same words of institution they use in the Eucharist as we use in the Lutheran Church. We would have a longer worship service every evening. And they stuck to the same service. Every service on Monday would be the same as any other service on Monday. Every Tuesday service is the same as every other Tuesday service. They're very strict about that. They keep it very ordered and structured. That's the way I found the Iona Abbey to be. It was very structured and ordered. I spent some time in Ireland as well. If I was to do another session, I would talk a bit about the laid-back attitude in Ireland. But even though they were structured in terms of the time slots, they were a little less structured in terms of everyone would get together in the coffee room or the fireside room in the afternoon about 4 o'clock and converse and talk. Most of the community would be there. They'd stop working. Everyone would stop working and go and sit around and talk, drink coffee, sit in front of the coal fire, play music, converse. I found that really wonderful. I got to know people really well. The Iona Abbey is, I think we have about half the people there that we have here at Holden, so it's a little easier to do that there. It'd be hard to get everyone together in one room here, I think. But they made time for that, and after dinner there's time for that. About 7 o'clock in the evening after dinner there's a time, this is before the tea break, and just before the worship service, everyone got together in the fireside room and chatted, played music, told stories, told jokes, whatever. It's very, very relaxed. The work wasn't as important as the socializing. Socializing was more important. People didn't work 8 to 12 hour days. They tended just to stop working and talk to people. I think part of the draw to Scotland for me was the idea of not feeling like I've got to be a workaholic. I can go there and I can relax. That work is important, but there's more to life than just working. And that became more important to me after spending time at Iona. The Iona community, they've got an outreach program, what they call volunteer flats or apartments in some of the main cities. There's one in Glasgow. Actually, there are a number of them in Glasgow, in different neighborhoods in Glasgow. And there were a number of them in Edinburgh as well. I'll get back to Iona again, but quickly, when I left Iona, I volunteered in Glasgow for about a month and a half, living and working in an area of high unemployment. The idea wasn't so much to proselytize. The idea was to live there in these areas of high unemployment and learn to identify with the problems that people face on a daily basis. Problems of not having enough money to buy your next meal. Problems of the government putting all their money into the weapons. Problems of violence on the streets. Problems of certain areas of the city where there's high unemployment being neglected by the people who have more money. Problems of people growing up in certain neighborhoods and being trapped in those neighborhoods, not being able to get out of the neighborhoods because they can't get a decent education because the schools don't have they aren't as high of quality as the schools in the more posh neighborhoods are. So people tend to be locked in a lot of times. So they don't go to the better schools, so they don't get the better jobs, thus they stay in the same communities, they intermarry in the same communities. A lot of the time there was talking with people, listening to people, chatting, listening to what their lives are all about. I can think of a number of people, Mrs. Hatterson, who had been living in the same place for 30 years. Her husband left her, he used to beat her. Her children, a couple of them were in jail. One of her sons sniffed glue.
Another one moved to London to try to get out of that. She was lucky enough to be able to get down there. Her boyfriend moved down there. She went with him. There weren't so many issues that were so black and white. Well, if you just preach the gospel, everything will be okay. Well, that's not the way it was there. I figure I was there learning from these people, and the people for me were Christ. They were there, and I was learning from them. They were ministering to me. Mrs. Hatterson is someone I'll never forget. She would come over and she'd smoke a whole pack of cigarettes in an hour and think of all the stuff she'd gone through in her life and say, gosh, she's very full of wisdom, a lot of wisdom. And a friend and I, we offered to take her into town to buy her a pizza one time. And she said, no, I'll just stay out here. Then a fellow named Nori, who has written to me since, for a year or 2 years, he'd been living out there in this Rikese district, trying to get a job doing volunteer work, working with kids, teaching kids orienteering. He wrote me about 4 months ago saying that he finally got a job with the youth corps there. He got into a training session, and he finally found himself a job. And I feel really good about that. I remember nights I'd help Nori home, take him home on the bus. He'd be out of the pub and just spend all of his dole money. The dole is the money they give to people in the United Kingdom to they give them a place to live, and they give them a certain amount of money to buy food or clothing or bedding, maybe new carpeting for the place. There are different ideas as to whether the dole is a good thing or not. We wonder there at times, though, if the dole wasn't meant to keep people in their place, give them enough to live on, but don't give them enough to be able to make decisions in the country. Nori would spend a lot of his dole money on beer, and once a month he would go out and get plastered. And I helped him home a number of times. The guy was very, very caring, very gentle. We would sit around for hours playing Scrabble on the floor in front of the coal fire. And when I left, the first letter I got from him said, well, you know, I've really missed having you around because I haven't had, there's no one to play Scrabble with anymore. Entertainment was very simple. We didn't have TVs, no stereos. I guess we had a stereo, very inexpensive stereo. People would stop in at the flat and to talk or to use the phone. There's only one phone in the whole area. It was usually out of order. So we, in the volunteer flat, we had a phone. And people come by to use that. Anyway, let's go back to the Isle of Iona. I wanted to mention a bit about that because it's an outreach program of the Iona community. Maybe similar to what in Minneapolis they have, what, St. Martin's Table, a place where a lot of whole nights hang out and do. I've never been there, I'm not from Minneapolis, but they have a lot of things going on from what I understand. So it'd be similar to that. The Abbey, they recently built this a place called the McLeod Youth Center. It's being dedicated in September. If I had a little extra money, I'd probably pop over there for the dedication. They're very youth-oriented at Iona. They do a lot with young people. The feeling is that by doing a lot with youth, that'll influence society in the long run. I really clicked with that. I agree with that. I think it's really important. We have youth weekends up here at Holden, and I think that's great. And there they also have time for youth. They have sometimes whole youth groups coming up in the summertime, constantly throughout the summer. They have programs just for the youth. And they integrate the youth with people who are younger than they are and also with adults, mix everyone together. So they just built this new place called the McLeod Youth Center. The symbol of the Iona community is the wild goose. The wild goose is a symbol of the Holy Spirit. And it comes about from the idea that the Irish and Scottish people are known for their love of wandering. So they have this bird, you know, kind of free, wanders, goes where it will. That's the symbol for Iona. I'd like to run down a bit of the history of the island. I have a brief outline here. I'm just going to go through it. in the ninth and let me start with, there's a saint not a lot of us have heard about, I don't imagine. His name is Saint Columba. We hear a lot about Saint Francis and Saint this and Saint that, and Saint Columba is the most renowned Scottish saint. Some would say Irish. Columba was born in 521. They say probably at Garton, which is in Ireland. That's about 25 miles west of Londonderry, which is kind of in the north.
About right up here in Northern Ireland. I say Derry, that gives away my political perspective in the Northern Ireland situation, but Columba was probably born up near Londonderry. A churchman of princely descent, and he was a founder of two religious houses in Ireland. About 546, he founded his first monastery at Londonderry, and over the next 15 years, he founded about 40 other of these monasteries, and two of the most famous are at Duro, which is 50 miles west of Dublin, and the other, which maybe you've heard of, is at Kells, which is 35 miles northwest of Dublin, if you've heard of the Book of Kells. In 563, Columba left Ireland, in part to satisfy his love of wandering, and in part as a self-exile. A lot of funny thing about a lot of the saints is they're normal people, getting themselves into a lot of trouble. We tend to paint Rembrandt pictures of them. Everything is right in place, perfect, you know. But that's not the way it is for a lot of saints. I don't think any saints are that way. You know, I love to see the other side of St. Francis, you know, his other side, his side that's not quite as prim and proper. I love to see that. Well, Columba is the same. It is said that in 561, a bloody battle broke out. According to a lot of sources, about 3,000 people perished in the battle. And the battle was between Columba's clansmen and the followers of the king. And according to Irish accounts, the battle began because the king had, this is a quote here, the king had violated the right of sanctuary at one of Columba's monasteries. In addition, the king had given what Columba thought was an unjust decision concerning the ownership of a book, which Columba had transcribed secretly from the original, which original was chained to the stones of the library where Columba's former tutor and abbot Finian resided. So Columba snuck in during the night to transcribe this book that this abbot didn't want him to transcribe. Columba had at first asked permission, but when he was denied, then he decided to go about it in his own way. Once Columba was found out, he and Finian got in a kind of a heated argument. They weren't too good of friends anymore. Columba refused to give his copy back to Finian, and Finian took the matter to the High King, and the High King decided in favor of Finian. Then the battle began. Iona's men, or Columba's men, and the men of the High King, or of Finian, and this is when all these people died. Columba, after the battle, felt like it was his fault that the whole battle began. He didn't intend for all these people to die in the battle. And he decided what he's going to do, since he was responsible for the battle. He said, these are words of Columba's, "I have committed a crime against God and Ireland. God I will pray to for the rest of my life. And for the rest of my life, I promise never again to look upon Irish shores." And there are various stories as to whether or not he actually upheld that, but we won't go into those. He vowed also to bring as many people to the faith as had died in the battle. So Columba and 12 companions set sail, and they eventually grounded on the Isle of Eye, or the Isle of Iona, as it is called now. There he and the other 12 men founded the monastery, and they converted all the people on the island to Christianity. Then they went off into the mainland and began to convert people on the mainland.
and Columba founded what was to become the longest lasting and most influential of the Celtic abbeys. From Iona, two of the most successful of the pioneering monks went forth into Britain and the continent, and also there Columba tamed his own defiant spirit into a gentleness still lauded by his countrymen. He taught scholars, worked in the fields with his monks, and protected the beasts and the wild fowl, which, according to legend, flocked about him. In addition to sheep on the island, there are a lot of birds. Birds everywhere. You hold a piece of bread out, and all the birds swoop down on you. And really, that's true. I tried once. You know, just lucky I was. Anyway, but there are a lot of birds there. I think there are a lot of birds on the Oregon coast. Monks were killed by Vikings. If I have time, I'll tell you about a little ghost story that they tell on the Isle of Iona, which has to do with those very Vikings. Between 814 and 831, the monastery was rebuilt with stone, and a shrine was erected to St. Columba. By this time, Columba had been canonized by the church. 878, the shrine and the relics were taken to Ireland. Between 1059 and 1083, Queen Margaret rebuilt the monastery. And I would say that... In history books, they had to say this differently. They had to say, Queen Margaret's servants rebuilt the monastery. Margaret had nothing to do with it. She probably didn't even touch a stone, you know. But by Queen Margaret, the monastery was rebuilt. In 1203, a Benedictine abbey and nunnery were established. And so that most of the existing remains that are on the island now date from the 12th and 13th centuries. And jumping ahead about 700 years here, in 1938, a fellow named Reverend George MacLeod, who is a minister minister in Glasgow, founded the Iona community to restore both the church and the spiritual life of the islands. He founded Iona also as a center of retreat where people could focus on social ills in Scotland, Britain, and around the world. I remember wandering about the abbey, I saw this portrait of this guy who looked really old. I said, well, who's that? And someone said, oh, that's George MacLeod. I said, oh, yeah, how long has he been dead? And someone said, well, he's arriving today. You know, so he's still around. He's about 85 or 86 years old. Fascinating man, very stern and staunch, very opinionated man. I learned to like him after a while. I didn't talk a whole lot with him, but I had a lot of admiration for him. Especially everything he'd done there. He's kind of like the West Pre of Iona Abbey. Because of George MacLeod, that's the reason Iona is there these days. He took a bunch of unemployed people during 1938, 39, 40 out to the island, and they all rebuilt the abbey. And they say it looks just about like it would have looked back when it was first built. In addition, this is kind of interesting, the abbey is a burial place for a lot of kings. Scottish and Pictish kings. And up until the time of Malcolm III, okay, the kings were all people up during that time. And it's also the burial place of certain English, Irish, and also Norwegian kings. Iona is also called Iua, which is actually the correct name for it. It's also called I Columcilla, which is the island of Columba. That's in Irish Gaelic. That's just a bit of the history to give you an idea of the historical context of the island. It's really fascinating. You know, here, everything is so new. Gosh, 100 years in Oregon is really old. But there, 1,000 years is old, and 100 years is really, really recent. And that was really neat. It gave me a lot. Very fascinating. Just for a break here, maybe what I'll do is tell you a bit about that ghost story, which I heard from a fellow. Iona is known for his ghosts. I was reading through a book there called Ghost Stories of Scotland, and there must have been 10 or 12 pages worth of ghost stories from Iona. And after I read that, in fact, it was at night after I walked out to the far side of the island by myself, just me and my tent. And the very place I was camping, I found out, was the very place where the ghosts hang around. Oh, wow, that's wild, you know. I didn't see any. But I thought maybe I'd go back there again and look for some, you know. during the 50s or 60s, I believe, there's a fellow out there doing some painting. He was off the north end of the island, and he saw, to his disbelief, obviously, a wooden ship, very long, with the bowed ends, rowing in to shore. And on the ship were a bunch of people with long beards and the typical Viking look, the Viking attire or style. They landed on shore and proceeded to unload all their gear, all their weapons. And he saw, by this time, he was kind of curious as to what was going on, whether he was just dreaming, maybe he was sleeping, for all he knew. And he went, he went and hid behind a rock, and all these Vikings went up toward the abbey. And half an hour, 45 minutes later, he saw smoke coming up from the abbey. And he saw there's a group of 10 to 12 monks, and these Vikings killed all the monks who had actually been standing on the shore. And they were killed after the Vikings landed on the shore. Then the Vikings came back toward the boat with all the sheep and the cattle that they kept on the island. Well, while the Vikings were up ransacking the abbey, just to prove to himself he wasn't dreaming, he painted a picture of the boat, of the insignia, actually the insignia on the boat. He went to Edinburgh, to a museum there, later on, and he brought this insignia of the painting. He went to one of the curators who was very well known, someone who knows a lot about the Vikings. And he showed this guy this insignia, and the guy took this insignia and he matched it up with the insignia of a Danish Viking ship. And they checked it out according to accounts of history. And I believe it was about, I think I said here, it's 763, something like that. I think it was 763 or 800, around that time, there was an account of Vikings, Danish Vikings, having come to the island, ransacking and taking all the cattle and killing all the monks on the island. That was one of the stories that I read. It's really fascinating. I kind of like ghost stories, and so it's fun to hear about that. It added a bit more life to the abbey itself. And even the guy, the bursar there, Ian and Kathy Galloway are their names. Ian was telling me about a ghost that he met there. He was walking up the stairs one day, up to the place where the monks used to pray. And he couldn't go any farther because he ran into a wall. And he said, well, that was probably all just old Charlie, one of the old ghosts, And he talked as if these guys were real. So I would sit around sometimes in the abbey and hear the wind whistling outside around the abbey. And I can see how people would think there are ghosts there. It's very fascinating. So if you go to Iona someday, ask them about the ghosts. Ask them to introduce you to all the ghosts. One of the neatest things, one of the things I really liked about Iona was the music. The music is an integral part of the community life there. And it's an integral part of the outreach. The music is written by there are two people who write most of the music for the abbey. They take old folk songs and old traditional hymns. A lot of the hymns actually are folk tunes, and they write them with modern words. Words that are very appropriate for the times, for the modern times. And I brought back a book of a lot of this music, and we performed a lot of that around here at Iona over the past year that I've been here. Like I said, last Saturday night we had a concert of all this music. Well, it wasn't all this music, some of it was that music. And I've got a couple of them on tape here, so what I'll do is I'll let you listen to two of these songs, give you an idea. One of them is a little lullaby. It's called Baloo Below. And The other is called Will You Come and Follow Me? It's to the tune called Kelvin Grove, which is a tune they use a lot for a lot of different hymns. So people are really familiar with the tunes, and then they just add new words. So, I'll put on some music here. I can't remember which one is first. The people singing this, one is Carol Mockestead, who works in the snack shop, and the other is a fellow named Brian Lloyd, who just left yesterday. He's a carpenter. This one is Baloo Baloo. And this is a little lullaby. Scottish lullaby.
Donations
from congregations. individuals. It's also funded in part through the Church of Scotland. Yeah, it's tied in with the Church of Scotland.
What do they do with the sheep? Do they eat them?
Oh, no, wolf.
Oh.
Yeah, maybe they eat some of them, I don't know. But I think a lot of it was they used for making sweaters and caps, a lot of things.
Do they spend wool there at the Abbey?
Not at the Abbey, but other people on the island do. There might be individuals that do that there. Mm-hmm.
Is that music written by a couple long-term staff people in the community?
They're people who are associated with,
Do they actually live there? Are the people outside who write for the community?
It's John Bell and Graham Mull. They're very much a part of the Abbey. They're in and out of there a lot, all the time.
But it's written for the community.
Yeah.
And would everybody sing these songs?
Yeah, they use them at worship.
Would they sing some without instruments?
Oh, sure.
So that you don't use instruments normally?
Either way. Uh-huh. They could be. Sometimes they play the piano with them. Other times they have maybe a guitar or a tin whistle.
Yeah.
Whatever. whatever's around.
Yeah.
Whatever people have.
Would they sing it harsher than that?
Yeah, maybe a bit. More the
Scottish or
rock. More the Scottish style.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I could, I used to be able to imitate it better. It's been 2 years now though, so I've forgotten how to do it. I was trying to do a bit of it when I was singing that there. But it's still a long ways from what they would do. Yeah, it's a little harsher. More, abrupt. A little faster, maybe. But it's wonderful music.
Yeah. Could you say something more about the emphasis on spirituality? Because, at least from my perception, Iona, down to the centuries, has been that getting into the faith. And I don't know. How do they do this? I mean, obviously a physical place can't do that itself, but the history... you mentioned they do a lot of meditating.
Well, that's not a part of the daily routine.
Mm-hmm.
There's less program, less structure, which I think gives more opportunity for people to do that if they want, mm-hmm. or to wander around the island, sit on a rock by yourself somewhere, just a few other people, watch the waves, listen to the seagulls. More contemplative, I think.
So it's not directive then, necessarily. It's not
no. There's a lot of silence during the worship services.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a community of monks or anything?
Oh, no. Not anymore. At one time there would have been.
Was.
Yeah, but now it's Protestant.
They were all killed in the 50s by the Vikings.
Yeah, by the Vikings.
That's right. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to. I feel like I'm really a part of the place there. It's had a big influence on my life. I'm not sure how to put all that into words. Some of the people I met, I like to go back, although I realize that it's time and money as well.
I spent a year at Hawthorpe in 1972.
Oh, yeah.
I had a friend who went to Iona and came back, and I was interested in going, and she said at that time there were 3 people there.
Really?
And I just wondered, has this place been continuously lived in, and when did this community become what it is today?
The place, at least when I was there, it functions year-round. I guess it shuts down for 2 months.
She said in the 70s, early 70s, the Abbey was almost, it was really decrepit, but they had to build it back up again.
Yeah, it's possible that after they rebuilt it in the 40s, that it's had to pick up momentum.
Yeah.
To keep people involved, to keep people...
So it was rebuilt in the 40s?
Yeah, in 1938.
And before that, it was not used?
No, it's just kind of an old... There are a lot of old structures, old abbeys, the ruins of places around
Britain. So a retreat center dates from about 1940?
Yeah. And even then, I'm not sure when it actually started to function as a retreat center. They rebuilt it in 38. But when it actually became an official place, center up for the church, I'm not certain.
So it was deserted for centuries?
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time.
Was anybody on the island for all that time?
Well, there are people living there, yeah. Herding sheep, mostly, and fishing.
Yeah.
a lot of people who fish there. There's an old nunnery on the island as well. They're talking about rebuilding that, making use of that somehow.
Is this for old nuns?
Yeah, yeah. For old nuns and old monks, you know. Yeah. Yeah, I ran into Theonius monk when I was there also. Do you know him?
No.
Oh.
I don't like being monk.
Is it hard to learn to sing in the different modes they use? It sounds like it would be.
Possibly. I was familiar with a lot of that, so it wasn't as difficult. Maybe for someone who wasn't familiar with it, it might have been.
How many other modes do they use to come?
Well, it's mostly the Dorian, the Aeolian, the Mixolydian. Yeah. They may use others, but those are the ones I've run into.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what was the youth program like?
A lot of the...
And what age groups?
It's tied into the school, well, not the school system, but I guess I would say kids from about 13 through 17 or 18, maybe to 20, talk a lot about issues that they're facing in their lives. A lot of it's similar to what we might talk about with youth here.
Were there activities planned for them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just things specifically for the youth. Maybe game sessions or... What's that?
And if you had younger children, what sort of things would be available for them, if any?
I don't remember there being a lot going on for the young kids. It wasn't anything like Narnia there on the island. You know, I don't remember there being a lot of young kids going up there. Not a lot of really young kids, maybe kids 9 or 10. Tended to be people who go there as guests tended to be what we would consider middle class people. And that's one thing that it's too bad that it's kind of gotten away from maybe bringing out people who are unemployed. That was the original intent, was to bring out people who were having a hard time finding work. And now it's become a place that people pay to stay at. They register long in advance, just like here at Holden Village. Although they encourage people to go out there who are struggling with unemployment and that sort of thing.
Would you go as a guest, or would you prefer to be employed as a volunteer?
After being a volunteer, I think it'd be difficult to go back as a guest, but I could. I thought about it.
Are they coming up with any ideas on how to deal with the long-term unemployment?
In Scotland. As much as they are here in the States. They haven't solved a lot of problems, really. As long as they continue to put their money into defense, it just sucks money out of job programs. There are, in different neighborhoods in the cities, there are social centers that try to get people together to talk about the problems and try to get people busy doing things. Well, my friend Nori, for example, he was involved in a city program to work with kids. They were training him to be a youth leader. So there are those sort of programs.
Were there other volunteers that weren't from Scotland?
Oh yeah, in fact, I'd say about half were from Scotland, and then the other half were from England, Ireland, Wales, Germany, Finland,
so they drew from all
America.
Over.
Yeah, it's very international. Well, I should maybe, let me close with this one little quote here, and then I can hang around for a while longer, but I better quit in case you want to go to dinner. There's a little quote from a woman named Evelyn Underhill, and in her, she says, Evelyn Underhill tells of a woman who had spoken to a gardener on Iona of the beauties of the island. "Yes, Mum," he said, "Iona is a very thin place." Asked what he meant by that, he explained, "Well, on Iona, Mum, there is very little between you and God." So, well, thanks for coming.